You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. 19 owls. That's how many species call the U.S. and Canada home. And while some, like this great horned owl, do go hoot in the night, the natural diversity of our 19 defy stereotypes. North America's owls range in size from the 4-pound snowy owl, which stands more than 2 feet tall, to the diminutive elf owl of the southwestern deserts, who weighs less than 2 ounces. The spotted owl inhabits deep, dark, old-growth forests, while the flammulated owl prefers open pine woods. And the short-eared owl floats over wide-open grasslands. All owls are carnivores, but their diets range from mammals the size of jackrabbits to insects like moths and crickets. Boreal owls hunt in total darkness, using only their hearing. Northern hawk owls hunt by sight in broad daylight. A few migrate with the seasons. Others remain on their territories year-round. 19 owls. 19 distinctive natural histories. You can learn more about all of them at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the war within the Rogers family. And the person telling me that story is Michael Healy, who's a friend of mine. Wait for that. If the We Charity scandal had happened in another country, they'd have made a movie about it. Not a documentary, but a movie. Lights, camera, action. Maybe cast both of the Ryans as the brothers. Owen Wilson as Justin Trudeau. And that's not just if it had happened in the States. Like a story like that, it's got celebrities, crime, politics, a child star's fall from grace, cameos from Oprah and the Dalai Lama, international, epic scope, sweeping story. If that had happened in the UK, they'd have made a movie about it. Australia, France, Germany, anywhere else. I'm not just talking about that story. If the Peter Nygaard or Frank Stronach or Gian Gomeshi scandals had happened elsewhere, they'd have made movies about those stories. If the Portapique massacre had happened elsewhere, they sadly would probably have made a movie about it. Wet'suwet'en, that could be a great movie. The Michael Bryant affair, imagine a Sorkin screenplay. I would watch that movie. And what about the Rogers family drama? Imperious and secretive billionaire telecom overlord clan, loathed across the nation, a doughy heir to the throne and his campy fashionista wife hanging out at Mar-a-Lago, his secret scheme to seize control of his dead daddy's empire, exposed by an errant butt dial, side plots about Masai Ujiri and Mayor John Tory. Yeah, if that had happened anywhere else, you bet they'd make a movie about it. But it happened in Canada. So they made a one-man play about it. As it happens, it's written by my friend, the brilliant playwright, Michael Healy. And he joins me in a minute. Wait for it. All right. Tell me your name and what you do.
My name is Michael Healy, and I'm a playwright. I work in the theater. I don't know why I felt the need to append I work in the theater to I'm a playwright.
Well, one thing that is wonderful about being a playwright is that you could write about anything. You could write drama about universal topics that anybody could find a point of connection with.
Correct, theoretically.
What have you chosen to write plays about?
You know what? Go yourself. I understand that the sandbox that I work in is dull, is aggressively dull. In the main, I write about public service. And so that takes me into the realm of doing for others. It's not a huge leap from there to politics and the idea of politics. And I've really found that politics is a very fruitful kind of area for me because there are two competing imperatives for somebody who wants to be in politics. And one is public service, and the other one is I need to get reelected. And those two things are in tension all the time in various different ways. And so that provides a lot of comedy. It provides the potential for drama. It provides farce and, in some cases, actual tragedy.
You're very defensive.
Yes.
Which will be necessary once you're attacked. But I'm actually just trying to give the listener a sense, as I speak to a miniaturist, of just how microscopic the area that you've chosen. You write for the theater, which people don't really go to.
Right.
You write about public service, a topic that very few people care about.
Yes.
You write about public service with specific reference.
Yes.
To Canada.
Yes.
You've written how many plays about our prime ministers and our...
Well, I mean, it depends on how you're scoring it. Like five or six explicitly about federal politics, and then a couple more about public servants, you know, non-elected people who are attempting to do a hard thing on behalf of all of us and who are thwarted in various entertaining ways until it finally crushes them, you know. So it really depends on how you're scoring it. But yeah, for the most part, it's like six or seven plays explicitly about politics.
You wrote a play about a public service urban development project in Toronto that did not proceed.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you'll be surprised to learn I had the entire field to myself. I did not have to race to get my play about Sidewalk Labs out before any of the other plays.
You weren't scooped. This wasn't like the Capote films or Armageddon versus Deep Impact.
Exactly.
You had the whole thing to yourself.
And I could just take my time. It was great.
I am in a unique position to really maximize the hypocrisy here, because the wonderful thing about podcasting is you could speak to the world from anywhere.
Right.
And you can make a hit podcast for the whole damn world.
Yes.
I chose to call it Canada Land.
Right, exactly.
So we kind of like have the same, I don't know, albatross or magic flute.
You, if anybody, should understand.
Yeah.
What I'm up against and how I've chosen to...
The corners that we've painted ourselves into.
Exactly.
And that I've spent a certain amount of time trying to tell the story of the Rogers clan.
Uh-huh.
There have been three or four episodes in the Canada Land archives. I've done deep dives into the Rogers family lore and archives.
Yes.
And we found a novelty song about Ted Rogers.
Come and listen to a story of a man named Ted, just a humble lawyer trying to earn a little bread, until he had an epiphany to put a Rogers cable on the back of your TV. Goodbye, rabbit ears. Hello, Mr. Rogers.
Hello, neighbor.
Now before too long, Ted becomes a millionaire. He and wife Loretta living life without a care. And then one day his young son Ed climbed up onto his knee and said, "What's next, Ted?" "Cellular phones, video stores, internet, Blue Jays, Rogers Center." And now you see the Rogers name in almost every home. They even got a thing they call the Rogers telephone.
Oh, God.
Ted actually, you know, was he an innovator or was he just sort of a gambler who was willing to leverage it all?
Right.
Because he saw the wave of cable coming.
Right. And then he saw cell phones coming.
He saw cell phones coming.
He said, "I want to like sell off some of the cable and get into cell phones."
Yeah.
And his own board said no, including his wife, who was on the board at the time. And so he took his own money and bought and built a cell phone company, which eventually everybody at Rogers went, "Oh, actually, good idea, bro." And then they became a division of Rogers.
So you've drunk the Ted Rogers Kool-Aid that he was a prescient.
God. He's a
visionary.
I'm being facetious.
From a Canadian viewpoint.
Yes.
If you work in telecom, who didn't see these things coming? You could just watch a few miles to the south to see what
so
was
so easy to say now. But
what's
here's be the Rogers board for a second.
Yeah.
And you are making metric tons of money just in cable across the country. And it's subscription-based, and all of the infrastructure's already there. And
did you have a Rogers cable box with the push buttons?
Oh, of course.
It was like fake wood paneling, like, like the station wagon that I drove.
With a thing that goes all the way to the back of the TV.
Yeah.
A cord, and you go clonk, clonk.
Yeah. Which itself was a technology that many people thought was not going anywhere.
Yes, of course.
But Ted knew it was, because it was already doing that in the States, and we just do what they do 5 years later. But exactly. No, he's a genius. Go on.
No, he's not a genius. I'm mostly kidding about, is he an innovator or is he just like a kind of an opportunist? But I think an argument could be made that Rogers Communications could have stopped as a cable company and then kind of fallen apart the way that the Seagram family fell apart.
Yeah.
Right?
That is true, that the traditional trajectory for a wealthy Canadian family is if you're making bucket loads of money off of something and it's in danger of being made obsolete, they cling desperately to the thing that works, and they don't want to risk anything.
Right.
And when he saw these waves coming, he gambled and faced resistance to gamble, and those gambles paid off repeatedly.
Yeah, at least twice.
Mm-hmm.
At least two times.
At least twice.
Cable and then cell phones.
And there were a couple that we don't talk about that didn't work out quite as well.
Oh, my God. Sure.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
We did an episode called The Rogers Family Compact that I just re-listened to. And if I do say so myself, when it comes to dramatizing the story of the Rogers,
yes,
you got some competition.
Okay.
Because I was there with Cherise Sucherin and Jonathan Goldsby at the time. It was a pretty fun episode. There was a conversation, just to talk about my own Rogers work.
Please.
Where we're trying to parse, to what degree can you consider somebody a self-made, like Horatio Alger, rags-to-riches case when he went to UCC?
In the heart of Toronto, Canada, at a boarding school called Upper Canada College, a young man was fulfilling his destiny. Ted Rogers was born in the spirit of invention.
And it is interesting because Ted Rogers, relatively, his father invented the battery-free radio.
Right.
In 1924, Ted's father, Edward S. Rogers, invented an alternating current tube for radios. That meant radios could be powered by electricity instead of heavy, leaky batteries.
Invented with air quotes. My understanding is the father actually bought a patent from a guy and then executed it, and so now is credited with the batteryless radio.
That's, I think, that somebody would have figured it out.
We all would have gotten there eventually.
To plug it into the wall without any batteries.
Right.
Somebody would have gotten there, but it was Ted Rogers' father. And then the family story goes that he died young, and I think he said some rogue fleeced the widow.
And so most of what he had was closed down or sold, or I say stolen, by some rogue.
Okay, stick around. After the break, we will continue the superhero or perhaps supervillain origin story of Ted Rogers. So where we left off, Ted Rogers is lamenting that a radio station his family owned was fleeced from his mother by some, quote, rogue.
For me, as a dramatist, I'm looking for the emotional connection in a story. And the lore is that the uncle talked the mother into selling CFRB, the radio station, and then Ted Rogers worked most of his adult life trying to buy it back because his mother had made this terrible mistake.
And apparently his mother brought him up with the marching orders for his life. You must restore the family name in the world of Canadian telecoms.
My mother was always very strong that I had an obligation to try and get it back and to do my best to get the family name restored in communications to what it was.
Which is a weird, as far as like sort of Shakespearean, you know.
In terms of mothers horning in on what you're going to do with your life.
Yeah.
You know.
Weirdly, my mom had the same advice for me, and we had nothing to do with the telecom business. but she was quite mad.
Yeah. Well, mothers, we don't need to go down. I mean, the play gets into parents a little bit.
Yeah.
Gets into that kind of legacy. You know, the play is about Ted's son, Edward, who eventually takes control of Rogers Communications away from his mother and his sisters in a very kind of bald act of corporate and quite public betrayal. And now he runs the place by himself.
This was a really rare moment in Canadian public life because when we talk about this class of family, you know, your McCains and your Westons, Canadian oligarchs keep a much lower profile. The Rogers were always a little bit different, mostly because of Suzanne, because Ed's wife is like fashion-y and extra and
right.
fun. But you didn't hear about Rogers fighting. You didn't hear about anybody fighting.
No, of course not.
I mean, I guess the Stronachs are a big scandalous
yes.
exception to that. But the Rogers suddenly are bashing at each other in the headlines. We were all over it because it's just not something that happens a lot in Canada.
That's right. And one of the sisters is tweeting, and there's, you know, public documents, court documents, so we've got access to everybody's perspective and what the fight is. And so, yes, it's a very rare thing to see. And I think that's why Alexandra's book, Alexandra Pozadsky, wrote the book Rogers v. Rogers, on which my play is based. She's a Globe and Mail reporter who followed the story while it was happening and then wrote a very carefully reported book about all of this stuff.
And you better be careful in this litigious country.
Yeah, that's right. But she was, and nobody sued her. And anyway, it's a great document in terms of a minute by minute from the initial blow up through the court case in BC of this family kind of getting fully exposed and then trying to tuck it all back in, you know?
My recollection of this was that, like a lot of things Canadian, even when they seem super exciting, they resolve to the least interesting conclusion.
Right.
So tell me if I've got the basic structure of this correct. You had, following the passing of Ted Rogers, sibling rivalry between his somewhat ne'er-do-well son, Ed Rogers, who was kind of like a fun party boy in university and then wanted to be the CEO, and Ted Rogers sort of dangled it and was like, well, he might not be the right guy for it. And then Melinda, who seemed like a bit more of the on-the-ball hotshot,
yes.
like, with the corporate chops,
yeah.
and this game of succession where which of the kids is going to get it, he was always sending mixed signals. And at the time of his passing, he said, look, it ain't going to be my decision, but it's not going to be one of my kids because it's up to the board who's going to be the next CEO,
yeah.
and neither of them are ready.
You're right there. About this. The succession planning for you is really on two tracks, isn't
on two it? Tracks. And Edward has been chosen by me and by
this
Will.
This is your son, Edward.
To be the second one. Now, he and Melinda would like desperately to also be the CEO, but that will be up to a board committee and then the board. And we have, as you pointed out, a fair number of very talented and experienced people. And so right now it would be, despite my being so proud of everything Edward's done, he's been there for 17 years. He's done every crappy job there is. He's not been spoiled. He's met his targets. So he says, well, why not me? And he's right, except that there are others that have more experience. And the board will have to make that decision. It's too hard for a father.
The thing about him is, at least in the narrative in the book and in the narrative that I'm pursuing, is that he was an unimpressive individual.
Uh-huh.
And his father said on many different occasions that Edward's not ready, Edward needs more time, he's like a fine wine, blah, blah, blah. And so he just found like many ways to insult his son Edward in public about this, about his competence.
Yeah.
And so Edward waited, bided his time, and eventually found himself in this position where he could do this. But really, a lot of that has to do with a kind of weird passivity on the part of the board and the members of his family, kind of counting on Edward, to not take all of this power that is right there at his feet.
The sort of norms of the company were to let the actual mechanisms do their business, let
yeah.
the board decide, let the market decide.
Ted had created all of these corporate governance structures that had to do with the choosing of a CEO.
Yeah.
The striking of a committee, this is what we're going to do. There was a lot of structure in place. The things that Ted Rogers would never have put up with, by the way, in terms of corporate governance. But he had all these things in place.
In that they were so formal.
And, they were so formal.
And organized. And,
yes.
and not dynamic and by the seat of your pants and gutsy.
That's
and,
right.
and impetuous.
He wanted family control to remain. But he also wanted the kind of professionalization of the corporation to happen. And that means bringing in outside people. He wanted both of these things. And they're in competition with each other. But no lawyer is going to sit there and tell Ted Rogers that he's being irrational.
Right.
You know, about his dreams for how his family maintains control of the company, but how the company gets fully professionalized at the same time.
Right. Those things are kind of at odds with each other.
Yeah.
So Ted Rogers stayed on as CEO until his death in 2008. After Ted's death, Rogers goes through a few CEOs in relatively rapid succession, but all of them have to deal with Ted's wacky planning. In that, to my understanding, they had to take the job even though Ted's ne'er-do-well son, Edward, could try and outmaneuver them at any time, right? In fact, there was like an escape clause built into the contracts of these CEOs. I think it was referred to as the Edward Rogers clause, right? Where it were like the CEO would get paid out their entire contract even if they were forced out years before the contract was up. And who was the first CEO to succeed Ted? Was that Nadir Mohammed?
Nadir Mohammed, you know, became CEO right after Ted.
He was there for almost 5 years.
$18 million was his payout. So, yeah, like he was in this ridiculous position where Edward Rogers was his subordinate as a vice president, but also he was on the board and on the control trust. So Nadir Mohammed was in this impossible circumstance where Edward was both his subordinate and his superior, and he lasted 3 years. If you believe a narrative where Edward Rogers makes it uncomfortable as possible for Nadir Mohammed in an effort to force him out so that he can try again to become CEO, then the corporate structure is still well enough in place that Guy Lawrence shows up, is impressive in an interview, but then starts making all these incredibly stupid decisions. So Edward Rogers now just has to bide his time because Guy Lawrence is, like, from the minute he shows up, his days are numbered because he just makes stupid decision after stupid decision. So in some ways, the narrative that I'm building in the play is that Edward Rogers just has to be patient.
And when he decides to make his move, he needs to deceive his own mother. All right, Michael, here we are recounting the trials and travails of the Rogers family saga. We're up to the point in the story where Ed Rogers, scheming to set himself up as CEO, needs to deceive his mom.
Yes, he needs to break his mother's heart and kind of push his sisters out and install his own CEO. And so then, as board chair, he can retitle himself as executive board chair. So he's effectively the CEO, and he's got a CEO underneath him who is willing to share the power that a CEO traditionally holds.
Those are the table stakes under Edward now. That's right. You're really working for Edward.
There's a guy named Joe Natale who gets brought in after Guy Lawrence. And so Edward now has to find a way to push out Joe Natale, who's seems like an extremely competent guy. And the reason I found the book interesting is he has to push that guy out so he can take over finally at the moment when Rogers is also attempting the
want to gobble up Shaw.
That's right. So number two in the telecom space is going to buy number four in the telecom space. And there's all sorts of reasons why that's a bad idea. And there's all sorts of regulators who are charged with stopping that or making sure that doesn't happen outright.
What role in your dramatized version of these events does the butt dial play?
It's peripheral. Like, in terms of every interesting...
See, I would have gone right for the butt dial, but
right.
You're a classier...
No, I'm not. Like, to continue the theme of this, I choose the least interesting path whenever it's available to me.
Right.
This, the corporate psychodrama of the Rogers family and Edward's pursuit of this job is less than half of what my play actually contains.
You're really interested in the regulatory side of things.
Here's what I'm interested in.
Where's the CRTC in this
exactly.
grand drama?
Well,
let's get to the good stuff.
So there is, on page 300 of Alexandra's book,
This
guy is introduced. His name is Matthew Boswell. He is the Competition Commissioner of Canada. And when he learns that Rogers is going to merge with Shaw, he decides that he is going to put a stop to this, that this is unconscionable. And this should never happen.
Mm-hmm.
This is ridiculous. The government has spent too long trying to create a fourth national player in the telecom space for us to just give up and let Rogers by Shaw.
Yeah. This has been the Competition Bureau and the Shaw Gene, a success of governments. If we could just get a fourth company.
Right.
Three companies the consumer gets screwed in Canada. We right. need a fourth company.
The magic fourth company.
And they have been waving magic wands to create fourth companies again and again, and they yes. just invariably get gobbled up by one of those three companies.
That's right. Yes, exactly. But this guy, no, this guy won't have it, and he's going to go outside his own comfort zone, outside the limits of what a bureaucrat is usually allowed to do.
Is this the hero of the play? Is the antitrust guy the like?
He's the hero of this play. I'm telling you, all of this stuff about the butt dial and the screwing his mother, that's terrible. Like, all of that stuff, I was not interested in Alexandra's book until this guy.
Until you got to the antitrust
until
stuff.
I get to the. Until
Hello.
Until I get to a public servant who is out over his skis trying to do a hard thing on our behalf.
Hello, suddenly, Hollywood.
Suddenly I'm interested.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
Now this is a marketable project.
Exactly.
Dear God, if you are confused by the discussion of a butt dial, the reason why Joe Natale became aware that Edward Rogers was scheming to oust him is because Joe Natale, at the time the CEO of Rogers, phone rings. He picks up his phone, says hello, and just hears weird muffled sounds, which we all know what that means. When nobody says hello back to you, you have been dialed accidentally. We call this a butt dial. And he recognizes the voices he hears. And it is Tony Staffieri.
Yes. And a guy, it's the other way. So Joe decides to call Tony on some matter. And Tony Staffieri takes out his phone. And the guy he's about to replace is calling him, so he's anxious. So instead of hanging up the phone, he answers the phone, and then he puts it in his pocket. Like, it's even dumber than you think. So
it's worse than a butt dial.
Right.
I just got fact-checked by a playwright. All right, continue.
So now Joe Natale is effectively in Tony Staffieri's jacket pocket.
It's, literally.
It's the pandemic. So he and this guy are sitting outside on a bench, and he's, like, talking to this lawyer, saying, "Ha, Joe Natale is about to get fucked. I'm going to take over as CEO. This is all hilarious. And would you like to come and be on my team?" And that's what Joe Natale overhears.
And this is how it gets out, if I recall.
That's right.
And then that's when you've got things like Martha Rogers, who we haven't mentioned yet.
That's right.
Who is a Rogers daughter who, according to her Twitter profile at the time, was a naturopathic doctor.
Yes.
But then when Canada Land realized that she hadn't been practicing, we checked to see if she had a license. And the College of Naturopaths said, you can't call yourself a naturopathic doctor if you don't have a license.
Uh-huh.
Leading to a lot of really unfortunate jokes about, like, what do you call a fake naturopathic doctor?
Oh, my God.
I actually felt bad for Martha Rogers. Because Martha Rogers was cool during all of this and was...
Well, she was tweeting.
She was tweeting.
Her brother was... So her brother didn't get to choose the moment because of the butt dial. He didn't get to choose the moment when he was going to execute the removal of Joe and the installation
of Tony. The only reason why any of this came out in the public, the only reason why Family Drama got aired was because of this phone call. Your play wouldn't exist, our podcast... This probably would have all played out.
Yes.
There'd be some references to it in the business section that we wouldn't know what it all means.
Probably, yeah.
And instead of that, we found that Melinda Rogers was vocal about this. Martha Rogers was vocal. We even got statement from Loretta Rogers that Edward had lied to her, given false right. information about Joe Natale's performance in order to get her support
yes.
to oust him. This is when it all became dirty laundry in public.
Yes. And through it all, Martha is very helpfully tweeting about her brother and about all of the shenanigans that he's attempting to execute.
A comic turn of circumstance that drives the narrative, not interesting to you.
It's of minimal interest to me, Jesse.
Yeah.
That's too easy. That's too boring. It's also, what do I fucking care about the Rogers family and how they spend their time or what they do?
Like, no, there's one good man, a public servant who says, enough to this oligopoly rule
yes.
in Canada. I'm taking a stand. And because he was victorious, he is the one we should celebrate on our stage.
He's not victorious.
No, he's not
he
victorious.
He loses. The Shaw gets gobbled up by Rogers. The only thing that the industry minister does is he says that you have to hive off Freedom Mobile. Shaw owns Freedom Mobile, which used to be Wind Mobile. You have to hive that off and sell it, but then you can go ahead and gobble up. And he does this, the industry minister does this, while my guy, Matthew Boswell, is attempting to build an argument, make an argument in front of a tribunal who's empowered with, who could stop this merger.
But they're all former Rogers employees on the tribunal.
Well, no, they're not. But they are in the bag. Part of what's interesting here is how in the tank for our corporate overlords our regulators are,
yeah,
our politicians are, and the CRTC, who lets the thing sail through while acknowledging that things will absolutely get worse for the consumer, but sure, go ahead and buy Shaw. So my guy is attempting to do this very hard thing. He's got nothing but headwinds. He's understaffed. He's underfunded. And he's trying desperately to make this thing stop. The thing that was interesting to me in the book, in all seriousness, is if I'm Edward Rogers, why am I attempting this corporate coup at the